Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Federal Court Litigation Inspiration, How to Get Started. I'm J.J. Area, AILA's Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Zachary Nightingale, a member of the AILA Federal Court Litigation Section Steering Committee from San Francisco, California. Joining Zachary are Olivia Serene Lee, the AILA Northern California Chapter Chair from San Francisco, California, Russell Abritin from Berkeley, Michigan, and Elliot Osment from Nashville, Tennessee. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Zachary.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to the second part of a two-part podcast on getting started in federal court litigation, particularly for those not used to considering litigation in your standard toolbox of options. We would highly recommend downloading and listening to the first podcast, which is entitled Federal Court Jurisdiction Over Denied Petitions and Applications. Like all these podcasts, it is free to AILA members, and it's on the Agora website. That one was recorded September 29th, 2016, and discusses some of the nuts and bolts of preparing and litigating a case in court. In today's second part, we want to address some of the more practical aspects when you decide for yourself that litigation is the best option, and then helping your client to decide that litigation is right for them, and then discuss what to expect once you actually file in court. And I'm extremely pleased to have outstanding AILA practitioners with us today with a wide variety of experiences that each one of them will discuss. So Olivia, Russell, and Elliot, thank you for joining us today to talk about your experiences in federal court. I'd like to jump right into the discussion with something that's probably on the mind of many listeners, especially those newer to litigation, which is, what factors should I be using in the decision, in the evaluation of whether my particular case is the appropriate one to take to federal court in a lawsuit? And to make things more concrete on that issue, I'd like to first direct it to Olivia. When you filed your first case in federal court, what kind of denial had you received from the agency, and what were the factors that led you to decide to sue?
Sure, Zach. The type of case that I had was an H-1B case. It was subject to the fiscal year H-1B quota. And so there was no opportunity to refile a case because we were dealing with a case subject to the quota. The case itself had a very egregious denial, and the facts were very good and we thought approvable. The record itself was quite well documented. It had about 500 pages, and we didn't see any value in appealing to the AAO because of that.
Did you conduct any research, any legal research, to find out whether similar lawsuits had met with success or not?
Yes, we did conduct legal research, and we did find that there were two district court decisions involving very similar fact patterns where the company was successful. We made sure we were very strong on our legal grounds, and we actually also reached out to those immigration practitioners and received their samples, briefings and pleadings to see if they were something that we could use in our cases as well. Other things that we did, we also reached out to AILA colleagues to see what their experiences were, and we also received tips to talk to people within our jurisdiction to see if what type of treatment our case might have within our jurisdiction.
And all of those factors led you to the conclusion that litigation in your jurisdiction made sense?
That's correct.
So, Elliot, when looking at some of these factors on the question of whether to sue or not, what are some of the factors that might counsel against a lawsuit that at least should be considered?
Well, that's a very important consideration before you go to the time and trouble of filing a lawsuit. First, you should look at the court that you're going to be filing your case in. If you can call other attorneys to find out what their experience has been, they can tell you whether or not that court, that judge, is likely to be friendly to a case like yours or might not be. Now, in a larger city like Nashville or some of the other places around the country, you're not going to know which judge the case is going to be before. But you have a pretty good idea of what the district in general atmosphere is toward cases. Now, that should also factor into your counseling your client. He's going to want to know what the likelihood of success is, and you should never guarantee an outcome, but you should be prepared to tell him the pros and cons of filing the lawsuit. There are other steps that you might want to take before filing. For example, you might want to file a motion to reconsider. Before filing, we have called the U.S. Attorney's Office because they would much rather not have another case to deal with, and sometimes just a gentle nudge from the U.S. Attorney to the appropriate agency might be enough to change the outcome. You also should take a look at refiling with a cover requesting supervisory review. We have sometimes used a liaison, and that has been very beneficial. So those are some other things that you might want to do preliminarily before you make the final decision to file.
One way to balance all of these different concerns is, as Olivia mentioned, to reach out to colleagues both in your jurisdiction and nationally. Olivia, who would you recommend reaching out to on a national basis when exploring this option?
So if you're working on a business immigration matter, I think that one of the first experts that you should reach out to is Leslie Dellen, who is the Business Litigation Fellow at the American Immigration Council. She was definitely extremely helpful in terms of guiding me to the different resources available that I should look at, practice pointers and practice advisories. She also recommended that I speak with Rob Cohen, who filed one of the successful case district court cases that I mentioned earlier. And Leslie also recommended that I speak with experts who regularly litigate in my jurisdiction. So in my particular situation, I actually reached out to you, Zach, and learned about how the processes and procedures of filing in the Northern District of California.
So Olivia and I have the benefit of a not particularly hostile jurisdiction in the Northern District of California, also within the Ninth Circuit. Not all areas of the country are quite as amenable to immigration litigation, and some might even be considered hostile. Russell, you're in Michigan. Is this a concern you have when deciding to litigate an immigration case in federal court?
In my district, in the Eastern District of Michigan, it's generally not a hostile environment, though there are some judges that are less favorable than others. Some of my cases get filed in the Western District of Michigan, where the judges there have less experience with immigration matters and are sometimes less favorable on issues. One thing that I do when considering litigation is, like Elliot and Olivia said, to look at prior decisions from the district and from the circuit. And if it doesn't look good, to see if there's another district that I can file in. And this is something that we covered on an earlier podcast. But sometimes you have a choice of districts to file in, that if the petitioner and the beneficiary are located in different districts, or the office that made the decision you're challenging is in a different district, you can choose between those districts and find the one that has the most well-developed body of law on the issue that you're raising. But if I have what I think is a strong claim, and even if the district is hostile and there's a chance of the case getting denied, if the client is willing to go ahead and wants to go ahead with it, I'm not as concerned with making bad law if I think it's in my client's best interest to go ahead with the case.
Once you become aware of, you know, the attitude of the court and all these other factors you're likely to encounter, and you as the attorney decide litigation is a viable option and a logical option, then you have to weigh those, as Elliot was starting to discuss, with the client and the benefits and risks of litigation. Sometimes the client is a corporate entity who would be instinctively hesitant to engage in a lawsuit against the federal government. So let's talk for a minute about how you approach this with your client and what you can expect your client's concerns to be. Olivia, did you encounter that issue with your client in deciding to sue?
Yes, definitely. So my clients, they tend to be hesitant to sue. They don't want their names in you know, more press, and so we had to, the way that we can approach this is to give the client the options. If there's an option, for example, to refile an H-1B, they may take that option over suing the federal government. In that case that I mentioned earlier, where this is a fiscal year H-1B quota case, there is no option to refile that H-1B. So for that particular client, the employee had no other viable option to remain work authorized in the U.S. And so the client weighed the options. We even showed them the district court decisions on those two other cases that were similar to the facts, and the client, our corporate client, eventually agreed to move forward with suing the government.
When you discussed with your client, was prospect of success important? I mean, that was obviously would be a factor for them. How important was it to them?
It was very important because of the time and effort that went into preparing this case, as well as potentially putting their name out there. There are, for example, people who look through legal filings to see if companies have been sued or will or are suing, and so. The companies that I work with are sensitive to this, and so, of course, if we were to make a filing like this, they are definitely concerned about the likelihood of success.
And courts tend to operate with a presumption that lawsuits and information would be public and should be public. Russell, what have you seen happen regarding, you know, a client's legitimate privacy concerns versus a court's openness presumption, and how have you dealt with that?
Well, I have two cases where this was an issue. One, which is only somewhat related to what we're talking about, was a circuit court petition for review on an asylum case that resulted in a favorable published decision. And within days of that decision being released, my client received calls from people in the community who are from the same country as she was from, asking her how she did it, how she won her case. And she was taken aback by that. In another matter, an ability to pay Administrative Procedures Act case, shortly after I filed a complaint, I received a call from a newspaper asking if I wanted to discuss the case, and I said no, and that was that. But otherwise, I haven't had any issues with clients being contacted by the media or other people in the community. The federal rules require that things like social security numbers, birth dates, minor names, and so forth, or names of minors and so forth, be redacted. But there are two exceptions that are relevant to immigration cases. One is administrative records don't need to be redacted. And two is there's limited remote electronic access to immigration cases. The only people who can access the actual documents on an immigration case remotely are the parties and their attorneys. The rest of the public is limited to the docket sheet and any decision. Of course, someone could go to the court and physically look at the file. That's not limited. In my experience, the government attorney, when they file the administrative record, asks me if I would like to have that record filed under seal. And I always agree to that to protect my client's privacy, and it doesn't impact my ability to access the administrative record electronically through PACER. Now, different courts have different local rules when it comes to requesting that documents be filed under seal. Where I practice, the local rule requires that you file a motion asking that it be filed under seal. You have to explain why you want it under seal, what documents you're going to be filing. You don't include the actual documents, but you have to identify and describe them. Explain why it's necessary and why there's not some other means available to protect whatever interests you're trying to protect.
So there's a couple different confidentiality-related issues that I hear in this discussion. One is the name of the plaintiff, which presumably involves at the very least the company and possibly the employee as well, being publicly available on that docket sheet that has to be filed. And then the second is the substantive information about the company that is part of the administrative record. And that is hard to get and possibly impossible for the public to get if it's sealed. Elliot, do you have concerns about the actual name of the plaintiff being public? And do you have any experience or suggestions on how to deal with that for a nervous client?
Yeah, if you have a case that involves an embarrassing set of facts, then you should consider filing what's commonly referred to as a John Doe or Jane Doe complaint. Instead of using the real name in the complaint, you use the name of John Doe or Jane Doe in lieu of the plaintiff's real name. And you file that with the court, and at the same time you file that complaint, you file a motion for a protective order under Rule 26 and file that at the same time you file the complaint. And in that complaint, or in that motion rather, attached to that motion, would be an affidavit supporting the motion as well as a memorandum of law, which explains the legal basis for filing the pleading under Jane Doe or John Doe. If the court denies your motion, then you simply file an amended complaint with the real name. But I think that's fairly rare. The most recent example we had in our office of that was when we filed a lawsuit against Corrections Corporation of America. We always love to sue CCA. And this particular cause of action centered around inspections of visitors to family members that were being detained in a jail. And when these women were on their menstrual periods, they were required to strip in front of officers. And that was in itself a very embarrassing situation. And so we filed a Jane Doe lawsuit against CCA here in the Middle District of Tennessee. And that was allowed to move forward under the name of Jane Doe. So that's how it's done.
Playing devil's advocate for a minute on this topic of sealing and not making the documents publicly available, I would think that could sometimes backfire if the documents are actually embarrassing to the government, and there might be a reason you, as the plaintiff's attorney, do not want them sealed. Is that something that you've all seen happen?
Well, yes, it's happened in the CCA case that I alluded to earlier. That's not the government, but they're acting in lieu of the government with governmental authority many times. And they filed a whole motion for summary judgment with lots of documents attached, and they filed it under seal. And CCA got in the hot water about that. And a few quiet calls were made to some press, members of the press, and they started inquiring of the court, what's this seal stuff from the CCA? And the judge very quickly corrected that situation and made the defendant that filed that go through each document and justify whether it should remain to be sealed or whether it should be refiled, not under seal. We are about to enter an era in which the government is going to do a lot, in my opinion, a lot of outrageous things. And we need to be prepared to let the sun shine on these illegal things and outrageous things. And it is not helpful for the government to be able to file things in secret. I generally don't favor filing sealed records by the government, at any rate, and only under extremely exceptional and unusual circumstances will I agree to the government filing anything under seal, unless it's in the best interest of my client to allow that to be done.
I think that tells us the moral of the story is that which can be sealed can also be unsealed. And so I think it's probably rare that things get unsealed, with the exception of the outrageous kind of action in the CCA case. But if you have an individual client and you've asked to be under seal, even though it's theoretically possible to be unsealed, probably it will not be. Let's move on, in the interest of time, and talk about the related issue of when you do initiate an action in federal court, how many documents relating to the substance of the case do you actually include, at least in the initial file? Russell, what's been your experience?
When I file the complaint, I'll include the just the documents that are essential to support the facts in the complaint. So I'll include, for example, receipt notices if it's a mandamus case, the denials if it's an APA case that's challenging those decisions. I might include a copy of the application or some other document that's essential to support one of the facts. But in the complaint, I don't lay out in great detail all the arguments and legal reasoning that I'll be making in motions for summary judgment in later briefing. So I don't need to include all you know, for example, an ability to pay case, I wouldn't include all the tax returns and everything else necessary to support that. And I'll instead submit those later on in the case, or if the government files them as part of the administrative record, I'd include just citations to the administrative record and not submit those separately.
Olivia, when you filed your H-1B challenge that you told us about earlier, how much did you attach in the initial filing?
I only included the complaint only. I did not include a copy of the underlying H-1B record because I was concerned about the company information becoming publicly available. And also, I knew that the government would, of course, already have it.
And once you actually filed, how long did it take before the government reacted by either taking some action or a filing in your case?
So in my case, because I only filed with the complaint, within 1 week I received an email from a paralegal specialist from the U.S. Attorney's Office requesting for the H-1B case receipt number. So that was within 1 week of filing. Within 30 days of filing, I received an email from an oil attorney. And then 45 days after filing, I received an H-1B approval notice by mail from USCIS.
So they had reopened and approved the case on their own, but obviously in response?
That's correct. And what's interesting is that I didn't even know that USCIS had reopened the case on its own. Again, all the interactions I had were one email from the paralegal specialist about 1 week after the case was filed, another email from the oil attorney about 30 days after the case was filed, and then 45 days after the case was filed, I get an H-1B approval notice in the mail.
Without any indication from the government attorney that that's what was going on in the background.
That's correct.
And then did that result then in the dismissal of the lawsuit as essentially moot?
Sure. Yes, it did. And the oil attorney and I had communicated by email, and we filed a motion for voluntary dismissal.
So you didn't have to even make the legal argument as to what the government's error was in a summary judgment motion or something like that?
That's correct. It was just a complaint that was filed.
So that might speak to the strength of the legal argument that was clear to the government once they were forced to act. Elliot or Russell, have you had other experiences where you do have to go to cross motions for summary judgment, and how long is that process for you?
Well, speaking for myself, yes, we've had that to happen numerous occasions. And as far as the length of time concerned, that's all over the roadmap. And how long the briefing must be is also all over the roadmap. It really is dependent on the individual judge. And what you need to be prepared to do when you are facing that kind of situation is find out what the local judge wants and what they require. And you can find that in one of three places. In the federal court, it's either in the local rules or in the judge's standing orders. Each judge has a set of those orders, or in the case management order, or the scheduling order, as it's sometimes called, that's already come down from the judge for that particular case.
Go ahead, Russell.
My experiences are similar. Most of my APA cases go through full briefing, motion, cross motions. When I file a complaint, I advise the client that after we file it, that they may receive something from the USCIS, like a new biometrics notice or an RFE or something, and that would be because we filed a complaint, especially in cases where I'm not the attorney of record, before the agency that another attorney had handled that. I want the clients to be on the lookout for that so they can share that with me so we can help them respond to that as part of the litigation. At least in the Eastern District of Michigan, the cross motions or motions for summary judgment and responses are limited to 25 pages, and replies are 7 pages. There's 21 days to respond to a dispositive motion and then 14 days to file a reply. Some judges require the parties to file cross motions for summary judgment. So by the time you file your motion, in response to the government's motion, and your reply, you're saying the same thing essentially 3 times. And it's better if there can be an agreement beforehand that one party will file a motion for summary judgment and the other party will file the response to cut down on what it by the end gets to be somewhat unnecessary briefing.
So I think the combination of those comments reminds us of the very, very important rule anytime you're litigating, which is know your judge and know the rules so that you can be as prepared as your opponent. When the opponent is the government in particular, they're usually in court day in and day out, and they know the rules backwards and forwards, and it behooves you to do the same so that you are fully prepared. Some cases will result in a speedy resolution, as Olivia's did, which is wonderful and a great experience, but you have to anticipate that the government may choose your case to put their foot down and really litigate for whatever reason. And I think, as Elliot noted, in the coming years, this is being recorded at the end of 2016 in the waning days of the Obama administration, and we had enough litigation as it was. In the coming years, we can probably anticipate a higher level of litigation and need for litigation. And with litigation being such an important tool in defending our clients against both improper delays and improper decisions, I'll invite each of you for some closing remarks on an inspiration on for those thinking about litigation. Elliot, let's start with you.
Well, for me, this was the reason I became a lawyer, and that was to advocate and litigate on behalf of underdogs. And if there is an underdog in today's society, it's the immigrant. And so I would like to ask everybody to look back and refresh their memory on why they wanted to go to law school in the first place. And in the coming years, there's going to be an opportunity for you to test that resolve. I hope that you'll revisit that, and if you haven't been litigating, reconsider that and put your foot in the water, put your toe in the water, and feel it. And I think once you do your first case, you'll be hooked on litigation as a way to resolve a lot of the problems that are going to be coming up in the next 4 years. That would be my encouragement to the people that are listening to this podcast.
Great. Russell?
I often get the feeling when dealing with the agencies that the officers view me and attorneys in general with some sense of disdain. And if they could run the system without us, they would find a way to do that. So going into federal court is a welcome change of pace. All of a sudden, you're the counselor, you're treated with equal respect to the government attorney. You go back and have conferences and chambers with the immigration judge, all the types of things that lawyers do and that we thought lawyers would do. And if you can litigate respectfully and successfully, it will improve your reputation with the agencies, so that in the future when there's a disputed issue of law or in the application of the law, the officers will give more weight to what you're saying because they know that you've fought them before and won, or even if you didn't win, that you did it well. And people shouldn't be shy about litigating. As has been mentioned on this podcast, there are many great resources at AILA and the American Immigration Council, practice advisories, mentoring, amicus support, even co-counseling. And that information and that those resources are extremely beneficial and very helpful in litigating, whether it's your first case or your 100th case.
Great. And Olivia, thank you for joining us as someone who doesn't normally litigate as part of her employment-based practice, but had a very, very inspiring experience in doing so. What other comments would you care to share?
I echo both what Elliot and Russell have said. The AILA community is incredibly helpful, and I've been very encouraged to reach out to other AILA members to talk about litigation as a strategy. I also echo the reviewing the practice advisories that are available through AILA as well as the American Immigration Council. And for those who practice business litigation, again, Leslie Dellen is just invaluable. If you do get hooked into litigation and you would like to follow litigation cases, I'd recommend also joining the federal litigation section of AILA. I, again, don't regularly litigate, but I have since joined the section, and I find it incredibly fascinating to know what's going on and what's being discussed in the federal litigation realm. And some other practical tips that I have for those of us who might be newbies in this area, I learned through my research and also speaking with other AILA members that, and I would have liked to know this, I guess, ahead of time when I first engaged in considering federal litigation as a tool, that courts have their own local rules and judges have their own standing rules. I thought that the FRCP, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, was all that I needed to know, but I also needed to know the local rules of the court as well as the judge's standing rules. Another practical tip is create a PACER account, and this is where you can actually look up cases by case type and also by jurisdiction. And the last practical tip that I have is double check who the Attorney General is. When I filed my complaint, the Attorney General just switched from Eric Holder to Loretta Lynch, and I'm sure the Attorney General will be switching very soon after this. And those are my words of encouragement.
Well, thank you all. This has, I think, been an extremely useful podcast, and I will just remind listeners that the Constitution created the check and balance system where the courts do play a key role in checking the abuses of the executive branch. And when the rule of law still applies, the courts will see themselves as the defender and even, ironically enough, as the conservative defender of the government abuses. And so don't be hesitant to use the courts as that stalwart against government abuses in whatever form they may take in the coming years. So with that, I will thank all of our participants today and our listeners, and that concludes our podcast.